All right, y'all, welcome to the show. I got a big one for you today. I'm playing catch up a little bit. So we're going to get to Israel announcing a new illegal West Bank land grab. We have Kamala's somewhat shocking comments about potentially punishing Israel if they go ahead with the invasion of Rafah. Look, I'll believe it when I see it, but I'm going to show you what she said. It's certainly more than I would have expected her to say. Then we'll get to the IDF TikToking more of their war crimes casually. And then later on in the show, we have a huge terror attack in Russia that we're going to break down for you. AOC admits that Israel is committing a genocide. This is something that when she was confronted about it not that long ago, she didn't use that word. Now she's using that word in speeches on the House floor and also on CNN to Jake Tapper's face. Then we'll get to Trump may get bailed out by a billionaire. You guys know that he owes $464 million for the fraud fine in New York. Looks like he may get a lifeline, although that's a little up in the air. The specifics of that are a little up in the air. Then we'll get to more Republican Civil War stuff. They're trying to oust Mike Johnson, who just became Speaker like 7 seconds ago. Marjorie Taylor Greene is leading that charge. And Destiny versus Jordan Peterson. That was incredibly unhinged. Wait until you see some of the stuff that JP said. Wild, man. Wild. So we'll get to all that and more. Everybody do me a big favor. Please subscribe to the channel. Helps out massively in the algorithm. Costs you nothing. We're trying to get to 10 mil. And that'll be a while. But you grow it one at a time. So hook a brother up with a sub. All right. Without any further ado, let's get into it here. A lot of stuff has happened on the Israel front in the past week or two. Let me go ahead and break all this down for you. So first of all, there was a UN resolution that came up. It was led by the US. And the way this was portrayed to the American public and the world more broadly is, hey man, we're trying to get a ceasefire. We are the ones who are in favor of a ceasefire. And this is how the media dutifully reported it. There's a problem with that though. It was actually not a ceasefire resolution. It contained all of the weasel words and the language that sort of dances around the question of a ceasefire and says like, we want you to engage in the process of determining whether or not there will be a ceasefire. So it was sort of like a smokescreen, in a sense. It was more kabuki theater. The U.S. wants to make it look like, hey, no, we're leading the charge because we want to stop the violence. But in reality, it's more deflection and obfuscation. And so what ended up happening is Russia and China and Algeria vetoed the UN resolution that the U.S. brought up. So let me break this down for you. Arnaud Bertrand says the following. And he's replying to this Associated Press article. It says Russia and China veto U.S. resolution calling for immediate ceasefire in Gaza. That's a very, very misleading headline from the Associated Press. He says that's quite dishonest framing by the AP, given that Russia, China and Algeria vetoed the U.S. resolution for the very reason that it did not call for an immediate ceasefire. Instead, it merely asked to recognize the importance of a ceasefire and to support American negotiation efforts towards that purpose, which wouldn't have changed the situation on the ground one iota. That's the text of the resolution. Quote, listen to this. The Security Council determines the imperative of an immediate and sustained ceasefire to protect civilians on all sides, allow for the delivery of essential humanitarian assistance, and alleviate humanitarian suffering, and towards that end unequivocally supports ongoing internal diplomatic efforts to secure such a ceasefire in connection with the release of all remaining hostages. So that's the weasel language. That's the, the flowery words used to try to puff up the idea that, no, this is an immediate ceasefire, even though, as you could tell by the plain face reading and interpretation of this, it's not an immediate ceasefire. As the U.S. think tank Responsible Statecraft rightly writes, the clause does not demand a ceasefire, but determines that it is imperative. Its support is not directly for the ceasefire, but for the negotiation process the U.S. has been co-leading and whose parameters the U.S. has sought to determine in favor of Israel. The text points out that this effort to secure a ceasefire is in connection with the release of all remaining hostages. This is an Israeli demand that is not likely to be accepted by Hamas in return for a time-limited ceasefire rather than a permanent one. This is something we've talked about a number of times. Of course, they're going to reject any ceasefire that's like a six-week time frame, because what's implied in that is as soon as the 6 weeks is up, we're going to go right back to doing what we're doing right now. They'd be insane to hop on board with that. As such, the American draft endorses the Israeli position in the negotiations and indirectly conditions the ceasefire on the release of all hostages, effectively making 2 million civilian Gazans hostages as well. the U.S. systematically vetoed all resolutions that were actually demanding an immediate ceasefire, so it's pretty clear they don't want one. This was a way to make it look like they were asking for one for PR purposes and for headline purposes from dishonest journalists such as the AP. Now, I don't know if the AP is being dishonest in this sense or if they just buy the State Department line, which is a lie, right? Like, they could either be stupid or they could be liars. But what happens now is exactly what you'd expect. So now the White House and all U.S. media outlets get to turn around and say, whoa, we were the ones who were in favor of a ceasefire, and we drafted a resolution to do a ceasefire, and China and Russia and Algeria, they blocked it. We're for peace, they're not for peace. So you see this game that's being played? It's nothing but PR bullshit, to sum it up very succinctly. All right, so now let me show you this. This video blew up a few days back, and it's always interesting to me seeing what are the things that pierce through and get beyond just the political junkies like myself and yourself and get to the mainstream American public, get to normie Americans, because you can never predict what it's going to be, but every now and then a moment breaks through. So this moment here broke through, and I think it's because of the undeniable nature of it. So Al Jazeera was able to get some footage here of an Israeli army drone that pursued four civilians, kids, and murked them. As you're going to see, they're not even the tiniest hint of a threat. There's no guns. There's no weapons. They're not in close proximity to IDF soldiers and threatening them. They are just walking alone on a road, and then this happens.
وقذائف الاحتلال وعلى طريق أشبعتها آلياته تجريفا انسحبت الآليات من المنطقة برا لكنها بقيت تترصد المدنيين جوا حصلت الجزيرة على هذه الصور من طائرة مسيرة إسرائيلية من أسطول يحوم فوق غزة منذ ما قبل.
So we'll get to this. We'll do a separate segment on this, but this seemingly was the straw that broke the camel's back for AOC to go out there and clearly state Israel is committing a genocide against the Palestinians. This was the straw that broke the camel's back for Alex Jones, the right-wing conspiracy theorist. This was one of those things that was so undeniable that it really woke up a lot of regular Americans to the brutal reality of what we're currently witnessing. Now, look, I have to say, I don't know why this was the one, right? We already have over 40,000 Palestinians who've been killed. 40,000. Over 15,000 children. 92% of the 40,000 are innocent civilians. They've bombed schools and hospitals and standalone UN buildings and marketplaces and mosques and churches and every kind of civilian infrastructure you can imagine. They told people in the north, you got to go to the south to be safe. Then they bombed them on their road to the south. Then when they reached their final destination in the south, they bombed them there too. Now, a million or more Palestinians are stuck in an area the size of LAX airport at Rafah, and Netanyahu saying, we're going to invade there as well. There's literally no safe place in Gaza. We have all of these facts that built up upon each other since the beginning, and nothing seemed to fully pierce the consciousness of the American people where they said, you know what, I think this is a genocide. Until this. So look, I'll take it that people are now waking up, but for the love of God, you should have seen this over 100 days ago, right? About 3 weeks into the post-October 7th, 3 weeks into it, it was very obvious what was happening. But this was the thing. By the way, Edward Snowden chimed in here. Everyone in the world needs to see this. Note that this footage permits no room for it was a mistake, showing repeated, specifically targeted strikes on the unarmed and even wounded. The sort of behavior the ICJ explicitly forbids in the genocide rulings against Israel. There you have it. All right, so Kamala Harris comes out. She does an interview with ABC News, and she says the following about if Netanyahu invades Rafah, what's supposed to be the last remaining safe place for the over a million civilians that are there in Gaza. Let's listen.
We have been clear in multiple conversations and in every way that any major military operation in Rafah would be a huge mistake. Let me tell you something. I have studied the maps. There's nowhere for those folks to go. And we're looking at about 1.5 million people in Rafah who are there because they were told to go there, most of them. And so we've been very clear that it would be a mistake to move into Rafah with any type of military operation.
A mistake, but would there be consequences if he does move forward?
Well, we're going to take it one step at a time, but we've been very clear in terms of our perspective on whether or not that should happen.
Are you ruling out that there would be consequences from the United States?
I am ruling out nothing.
I want to ask.
So look, I'm a bit skeptical and I'm a bit cynical and jaded at this point. So my reaction to this is, okay, Kamala, I'll believe it when I see it, right? I'll believe it when I see it. But having said that, it's definitely a video worth watching to understand what the new line is coming out of the administration. So they've yet to draw any red lines at all in any way, shape, or form. So like I said, I'm very, very skeptical, but this certainly is harsher language than they've used previously. Okay, look at this. Israel announces largest West Bank land seizure since 1993 during Blinken visit. So yet again, this is another example of the Israeli government putting up a middle finger to the U.S. government. And in fact, it's going beyond that. It's spitting in the eye of Joe Biden and the White House. That's what this is. It's, oh, you think you wear the pants? You think you're in charge? You think we are your colonial outpost? How about we do what we want and you keep arming us and funding us? That's what this is. And like in the movie Tombstone, I would say to Biden, what, are you going to sit there and bleed? Because the answer so far has been yes. But now they're going above and beyond. By the way, again, let's be clear. Announcing an illegal West Bank land grab, you do understand Hamas controls Gaza. Hamas does not control the West Bank. The West Bank is controlled by the Palestinian Authority and Mahmoud Abbas, and they're viewed as basically collaborators with the Israeli government. So what this does is it demonstrates for you, it doesn't matter what Palestinians do. The reaction from the Israeli government is always the same. If it's Hamas, oh my God, you're violent terrorist extremists, we can never work with you. If you're the Palestinian Authority and Mahmoud Abbas, they listen to the IDF all the time, but then boom, their land still gets stolen. And there's still violence enacted against Palestinians there. So damned if you do, damned if you don't, if you're Palestinians. That should be crystal clear to everybody. All right, now, look at this. Israeli forces raped and then killed women at Al-Shifa Medical Complex, said Palestinian woman Jamila Al-Hisi, who is besieged at the hospital, to Al Jazeera. According to Jamila, occupation forces raped women and then killed them. Occupation forces burned and killed entire families. We haven't found food or water for 6 days. We appeal to the Red Cross to provide water for the children and the sick. The occupation forced 65 families to leave the area around the complex. Occupation forces burned the building we were barricaded in. We don't even have water to break our fast, and we don't know where to go. This verifies something that the UN came out with a couple weeks ago about how there has been many rapes of Palestinian women at the hands of the IDF. Now, this is one of those I told you so moments, but to be fair, it's not just me. It's a number of people who were looking at what was happening on the ground. Haaretz says the following. A Palestinian poll shows a sharp rise in support for Hamas's October 7th attacks among Gazans to 71%. Up from 57% 3 months ago. Gee, I wonder why the support for Hamas shot up massively. Really tough one to figure out. Can't quite piece it together. Could it be that when Israel is trying to do a wholesale ethnic cleansing and genocide of the Palestinians, and they've killed 40,000 Palestinians, including 15,000 children, and they've destroyed virtually all of North Gaza? Could it be that violence and brutality begets more violence and brutality? And of course, if you're a Palestinian, you're going to want your own badass hardliners who say, I'm going to stand up and fight for you. I'm not going to let them just roll over us. Could it be that that's the case? So as I pointed out 1,000 times over, the idea that Israel says, oh my God, we're going to wipe out Hamas. We're going to destroy Hamas. There's going to be no more Hamas after this. How do you plan on doing that when probably in the time span of this war, you quadrupled the number of Hamas members. Do you know how many more people, how many more orphaned kids are now going to step up and say, I got nothing to live for. All I want is revenge and retribution. That's what's going to happen. So to the extent their actual goal is to eliminate Hamas, which it's not, but to the extent it is that, well, they objectively failed miserably because you're at least going to quadruple the recruitment for Hamas. And if they were to theoretically destroy Hamas, there'd be Hamas 2.0 in about 7.5 seconds. Who are we kidding here? So of course this was going to be the reaction. Jesus Christ. All but two Democratic senators just voted to give Israel $3.8 billion in weapons, violating U.S. law, defund a U.N. inquiry into Israel's violations of international law, defund UNRWA, worsening famine in Gaza, sanction the U.N. Human Rights Council if it highlights Israeli abuses. I know you're probably wondering who are the two Democrats who voted against these things. It's only Bernie Sanders and, get this, Michael Bennett, because to him, this bill didn't have enough support for Ukraine in it. So, yeah, he voted against it, but there's a little asterisk there, right? Like, it's not like he did it for the correct reasons. Bernie's the only one who said, this is crazy, we can't do this. God damn. So you're probably thinking, just like everybody else, man, what would Israel have to do to get the money and weapons cut off? Literally, what would they have to do? And I got to be honest with you, I don't know if there's anything they could do that would lead the U.S. to actually cut off the weapons. I mean, maybe if they nuked Gaza, maybe then it would be like, okay, we're going to reduce the money going to them or temporarily suspend it, but bring it back in about 6 months. I don't know. I don't even know if nuking them would make it so that they say, you know what? We're going to cut off the weapons. But make no mistake about it, by the way, this makes us guilty as well of facilitating the genocide. There's no doubt, because we know what's going on now. There's no open question about it anymore. And also defunding UNRWA, which is the agency of the UN, which is giving the humanitarian aid to Palestinians at this moment. That is the U.S. saying, we will also sign up for starvation and famine. We will also do collective punishment of over 2 million Palestinian civilians. That's what this is. More children were killed in Gaza during the first 4 months of the genocide than were killed in all armed conflicts in the world between 2019 and 2022. That's a fact that should stick with you. All right, so now let's play this. Ken Klippenstein tweeted it. The Pentagon has no idea how aid would be delivered to Gaza from the pier it pledged to build. Jesus Christ. So as I pointed out early on when they announced this pier thing, it looked to me to just be PR ass covering. And I say that because if the U.S. wanted to insist on getting humanitarian aid to Palestinians, it's not that difficult to do it. Biden picks up the phone, calls Netanyahu, and says, I'm going to make this very simple. You either allow in 100% of the humanitarian aid, or you lose your money, you lose your weapons, you get condemned at the UN, you get sanctioned. That's all you have to do. One phone call, and it could be done. Instead, he hasn't made that phone call, and Biden knows that Israel is blocking over 70% of the aid going into Gaza. And they're not blocking it because, oh my God, there's some legitimate reason or there's bureaucratic red tape. No, they're doing it on purpose to starve Palestinians. So then came this goofy idea, this PR ass-covering maneuver of we're going to build a port. Well, that takes a long time, and people need the relief now, right? But then the second thing is, the logistics of that are also super difficult. And so when asked for more specifics on how the aid is going to be delivered once it's done, you get this answer.
And then on the pier, the Benavides set sail today.
Yep.
So we've got the pier elements moving forward. You've got the sailors and soldiers are starting to move forward.
Yeah.
What's going to be the Pentagon's role in kind of that final mile? Are you letting contracts for contractors to then deliver that aid into Gaza? What's kind of the final piece looking like?
So that's still something that's being worked out right now. And in terms of the distribution, that's not something that the U.S. military will be involved in. We are, the logistics, setting up, coordinating the movement of the humanitarian aid from either the floating pier or to the that floating causeway. But that's something that, in terms of how the distribution of aid is going to happen once it gets into Gaza, that's not something that, you know, we're handling. In terms of contracts or, you know, how that's going to be done, whether it's through partners and allies, NGOs, I just don't have that for you right now. We're going to get there, though.
Okay. So just to be clear, like, but will the Pentagon actually let the contracts that would distribute that final mile, or is that going to be state, or do we know actually who's going to be handling that?
There will be no U.S. military on the ground in Gaza. So again, who's handling that? I just don't have that for you.
The agencies.
So look, this is where you open the door for people to rightly speculate about your true intentions and what the point of this really is, right? So there's a number of different options. Number one, this pier, like I said, is an ass covering maneuver, and it may not even be built when all is said and done, right? It's going to take a long time anyway. As we know, they need the relief right now. This isn't a real solution. This is a solution to the PR problem of people knowing, hey, it looks like you don't give a fuck about these Palestinian civilians and they're going to die. And it's like, well, let's do this really convoluted, over-the-top, ridiculous plan in order to make it look like we care about the Palestinian civilians. So ultimately, it might not even be built, okay? Having said that, it also could be built. And in that scenario, there's further speculation about what the pier is really for. Some have speculated, and this is just speculation to be clear, we don't know for sure, but the pier could be about the natural gas that's off the coast of Gaza. That's one piece of speculation. Another is, the pier could be a highfalutin way to try to get Palestinians out of there and ethnically cleanse the region even more. And the thing that we know about the pier, which just came out a week or two ago, is that it was actually Netanyahu's idea. And Biden put it out there like it was his own idea. I think enough has been said on this front. This is inexcusable. All right, so one of the things we've seen from the beginning of this all is that the IDF has not hesitated to TikTok or live stream or post their various war crimes. And they're proud of it. And they brag about it. So now we have this new example. It has to do with a pool in Gaza and the reaction of the IDF. If we don't get a pool, no one does, is what this guy says. So they just blew up the house with the pool. I guess Hamas was hiding under the pool, right? Is that what we're led to believe? Again, I don't know how anybody could look at this and then walk away thinking, Israel never targets civilians or civilian infrastructure. Well, how many fucking videos do you need to prove it to you that that's literally exactly what they're doing? This idea that we superimpose benign intentions on Israel or a defensive posture in Israel, absolutely absurd. How much more evidence do you need? All right, this one's hard to look at. I mean, look at this picture, man. Look at this picture. The New Yorker had an article, "The Children Who Lost Limbs in Gaza." And here's a picture of a little girl who lost her leg. "The children who lost limbs in Gaza, more than 1,000 children who were injured in the war, are now amputees. What do their futures hold?" They were doing amputations, and might still be doing amputations, of limbs for 10 children a day. And by the way, without anesthesia. Tell me more about your hunt for Hamas, please. All right, we got more IDF war crimes posted on social media. Mute this. So they're joking around like, yeah, we're like playing by the beach. What a beach, a bouncing ball on Gaza beach. They're having fun. Blowing up some sort of a beach ball here. 7 weeks, we're here a long time. Yeah, they're kicking around a ball in an apartment building that they stole from Palestinians, attacked countless people around it, and they're having fun, man. They're having fun. They're really being defensive and protecting themselves, and now they're looking at the beach in Gaza and no doubt salivating about the resettling of the area. You guys know there's been a number of conferences with high-ranking Israeli government officials where they openly talk about the real estate on the water in Gaza. I'm going to have more on that for you in a little bit. We have a settler who comes out and says the quiet part out loud. Israeli West Bank settlers are seeking to resettle Gaza. Already enrolled 500 families. Okay, let's watch some of this. This is from CNN.
High in the hills of the occupied West Bank, a flag flies in the face of a Palestinian village. God is king, it says. Two young settlers guard this illegal outpost. Construction hasn't even begun, but we are not welcome.
So they're asking us to leave. They don't want to talk to us. They said they've been here for about 9 months.
Dotted across the landscape, more signs of the fight to assert Israeli control over Palestinian land. The Arabic names on signposts crudely erased. Under international law, the Beit Hogla settlement is illegal. But last February, the Israeli government officially recognized it along with eight others, a move the U.S. strongly opposed. We're here because God promised us this land, Azriel Picard tells us.
Now, I want you to stop and think about the argument that, say, Sam Harris uses when talking about this conflict. His idea is actually very similar to Netanyahu's idea. You have the forces of light versus the forces of darkness, the enlightened versus the barbaric. And, you know, one of his main claims is those fundamentalist Muslims are so extreme, there's no working with them or negotiating or finding peace. They are drunk on the Kool-Aid of the Quran and Muhammad, and they are bloodthirsty, and they're religious extremists, and they really believe their texts. And here you have this guy. I mean, we're literally a minute into a CNN report. CNN has done generally a poor job covering this, right? But even they can't deny it at this point. This guy's like, God promised us this land in Gaza. God promised us this land. By the way, that's exactly what the West Bank settlers say as well. The illegal West Bank settlers. Jesus Christ.
Now,
so anyway, do you see his criticism coming against the other side? Do you see him talk about the religious extremism on the Israeli side? To the extent he talks about it in the context of this conflict, it is a side point. And the main focus is on one side is bad, the Palestinian Arabs and Muslims, and one side is generally good, the Israeli Jews.
These settlers have set their sights on a new prize, one that seemed utterly impossible before October 7th. Returning to Gaza, they cheer. That is the goal of Zionist settler organization Nahala, one of more than a dozen groups now advocating for the reestablishment of Israeli settlements in Gaza. A recent promotional video even boasts that Gaza will become the next Riviera. Daniela Weiss is the godmother of the movement. She's already started recruiting from the 700,000-strong settler community of Israel.
We're just arriving now at a settlement in the occupied West Bank, and we're heading to a talk that Daniela Weiss is giving to a group of people who are potentially interested in resettling Gaza.
We are for the land of Israel and Ben-Gavir, she says. About 20 people gather in the living room of a family home. Weiss knows that for many in this community, there is deep nostalgia for Gush Katif, a block of 21 Israeli settlements that were forcibly evacuated by the IDF in 2005 when Israel left the Gaza Strip.
Full context on that, they didn't leave the Gaza Strip full stop. They removed the few settlements that were inside Gaza, and then they basically did a full perimeter border military checkpoint where they turned Gaza into effectively an open-air prison. That was the move. I believe it was Ariel Sharon. That was his brilliant move to then separate the West Bank from Gaza and have this talking point of, bro, we're not even in Gaza anymore. I don't know what you're talking about, bro. I'm sure you've heard that 1,000. In 2005, we left Gaza. Where did they leave to? Where did they leave to? The perimeter. The border. Where they were hyper-militarized, and they don't allow flow in and out of goods or people. So it is still an occupation, it's just a different kind of occupation from proper settlements within Gaza. So that's the full context of that.
This is the vision of Gaza, she says. You see all the nucleus groups. A map has already been drawn up, with six groups laying claim to different parts of the enclave.
So they've just been handing out these little booklets that say, People of Israel, return home, and then underneath, a call to return to the settlements of Gaza.
One of the organizers tells the group they have a representative flying to Florida to raise money. Nahala gets support from a number of groups in the U.S., including AFSI, Americans for a Safe Israel, which co-sponsored a recent webinar on the...
How ironic is that? Americans for a Safe Israel, and their idea to make Israel safe is to steal Gaza ethnically cleanse it and set up illegal settlements there. Yeah, that'll make it safe. That won't spark a colossal backlash, rightly so. Jesus Christ.
Turn to Gush Katif, even as the Biden administration has cracked down on settlements in the West Bank.
There is a very strong support from very prominent, from very, I would say, wealthy people, wealthy Jews.
In the U.S.?
In the U.S.
Can you name any names?
No, I cannot.
Gee, I wonder why. Could it be because they're violating international law? Gee, I wonder why they can't name names. Go ahead. By the way, go ahead and watch the rest of this video. Astonishing. Just stunning stuff, man. It's all out in the open. It's all out in the open. And then people will still deny what's going on here. CNN reports that at least 19 people have been killed from Israeli fire on Gaza residents who were waiting for humanitarian aid. Oh, would you look at that? Another flower massacre. Almost like they're happening all the time here. Must be some dastardly Hamas plot that was foiled by the brilliant idea. This was from Axios. Scoop. Blinken warned Netanyahu and his war cabinet in a meeting on Friday that Israel's security and its place in the world are in peril over failed Gaza strategy, and quote, you might not realize it until it's too late. So in other words, yet again, another finger wag. Sir, you're being a little too blatant with your war crimes. Reel your war crimes in 12.5% so you can let us save face and run cover for you. Again, that's what I think this is. Prove me wrong. Prove me wrong. I would love to be proven wrong. Blinken, Biden, any of you guys. You want to take actual, you want to make Israel pay any actual consequences? Cut off their money, cut off their weapons. You know they're going to invade Rafah. Do it and do it now. I won't hold my breath. Israeli soldier openly admits to war crimes. Quote, we blew up the houses of terrorists, mosques, UN offices. I remember we got into some UN office in charge of helping families in Gaza affected by the war, and we destroyed it.
My unit was in charge of explosions. We blew up houses of terrorists, mosques, UN offices. I remember we got into some UN office that was in charge of helping families in Gaza that was affected by the war, and we destroyed it.
As I've pointed out time and time again while covering this, what you see is oftentimes the Israeli government and Israeli citizens who support this and the IDF, they are way more open and honest with what they're doing and what they support than what you see in typically Western media, with some exceptions, and from U.S. politicians. So, I don't know, whose word do you take on it? I believe what my eyes show me, what the evidence points to. All right, so now, we talked about Alex Jones the other day. Alex Jones came out and said, Israel has lost the high ground. This is not war. It is robotic mass genocide. He basically goes on to say, Israel's committing genocide, and this is like kind of obvious at this point. That was a surprise to many people that Alex Jones said that. And now, I believe this was from a little while ago, I think, but Tucker, also is saying similar things, not as strong as what Alex Jones is saying, but let's listen.
U.S. aid, military aid to Israel and the implied security guarantees, some explicit, but many implied security guarantees of the United States to Israel probably haven't helped Israel that much long term. It's a rich country with a highly capable population. Like every other country, it's probably best if it makes its decisions based on what it can do by itself. And I don't see any advantage to the United States. I mean, I think it's important for each country to make its own decisions. Again, I don't think you can overstate the lack of wisdom, weakness, short-term thinking of American foreign policy leadership. These are the architects of the Iraq War, of the totally pointless destruction of Libya, totally pointless destruction of Syria, and the 20-year occupation of Afghanistan that resulted in a return to the status quo. So like of the Vietnam War, their track record of the Korean War, even going back 80 years, is uninterrupted failures. I just don't have any confidence in those leaders to improve. When was the last time they improved another country?
So as I always point out when discussing these conservative folks who are not pro-Israel, there's usually two schools of thought on the right when it comes to Israel, broadly speaking. You have what I'd call like the Richard Hanania types, which are honestly just kind of jealous of the fact that Israel has an ethno state. So they support it. also they do the, you know, eugenics, race science type stuff where it's like, oh, you know, Ashkenazi Jews, really high IQ. We got to ally ourselves with the folks with the really high IQ. So there's one group that's just over the top, fawning, adoration, love for Israel. Then you have the other group, which you should be somewhat skeptical of because there's a lot of, let's call it what it is, a lot of Nick Fuentes type opposition to Israel, where, you know, from Nick Fuentes's perspective, there's an evil satanic cabal of dastardly Jews who are secretly running the world, and Israel is the purest manifestation of that. And so that's why they oppose Israel. So there are those two schools of thought on the right. If you want to be kind, you can say a third school is just the somewhat non-interventionist, isolationist types who just don't want the U.S. to be bogged down in wars for other countries, etc. That's if I'm really steel-manning the perspective. But always be a little skeptical when you see arguments coming from certain corners here, because usually it's not with the purest of intentions. Now, having said that, as I pointed out to you guys, a lot of this recent shift is from that one video that undoubtedly shows these young boys walking, probably, you know, teenage boys or whatever it is, walking and just getting murked out of nowhere when they're not even a tiny threat. That seems to have woken up a lot of people to the nature of what's really going on here. It's validated the most aggressive perspectives against Israel and shown this for what it is, really ripped the mask off of it. All right, so now I'll show you this. Net support for the U.S. providing humanitarian aid to help Palestinian civilians. It's plus 30 overall. In other words, people see what's going on the news. They see the devastation, and they can't help but feel sympathy and want to help. Among 18 to 29-year-olds, they're plus 31 to send humanitarian aid to Palestinians. 65 and older is actually plus 41. I'm kind of surprised by that older people are actually more in favor than younger people. Among Muslims, it's plus 65%. Among Jews, it's plus 41%. So in other words, basically every group, every demographic in this country is like, man, look at what's going on there. It's unacceptable. They need help and we got to send it to them. All right, so here we go. Another example of people openly discussing what their plans are.
We love the Gaza Strip. We can't just take a whole strip of land and say Israelis can't live there. It doesn't make sense. This is our sovereign state.
Would you live there?
Of course.
By the beach?
Oh, for sure. Yes, my husband's also talking about building. He has a yeshiva, a Talmudic institute here. So building a branch in Gaza. We have lists already about 500 families that are willing, on the drop of a hat, to just move into, we have north, central, and south Gaza. And people are going to start building towns. We have names of the towns. We have where we're building them. It's already being planned. And we have people signed up. You can't leave it without Jews in the Gaza Strip. It's too big a piece of land. It's too important for us to let it become Hamas town, as we call it, full of terrorists. We love the...
So here you have a New Yorker from Brooklyn. She's like, yeah, illegally steal it, resettle it. That's what we need to do. And finally, I'll leave you with this. So Jonathan Greenblatt, the head of the ADL, agreed with this tweet. There's no whinier human alive than the anti-Zionist Jews. Most of them probably fake, who are now raging in the responses to my wife's extremely reasonable tweet. As Jason Rosenberg points out, ADL CEO endorsing a tweet calling anti-Zionist Jews fake Jews. Every time I think Greenblatt and ADL can't go lower, they do. By the way, Greenblatt and the ADL were leading the charge to try to get TikTok banned. They're trying to get that bill through the most. Why? Because there's a lot of pro-Palestine stuff and anti-Israel stuff on TikTok, and they can't allow that. They want to censor that. They want to ban that. All right, guys. So as soon as I finished recording my full Israel segment, we get a colossal update that I have to share with you. And this, for the first time in a very long time, is potentially phenomenal news. So the UN Security Council, which, by the way, is where the actual decisions are made, is not the General Assembly, which is more like, you know, virtue signaling bills passed. This is where the actual power rests. The Security Council passed a Gaza ceasefire. The U.S. didn't vote for it, but they abstained, and all the other countries voted in favor of it. So for the first time, that allows it to stand. The U.S. does not block the resolution, and this resolution is apparently not one of the bullshit Weasley ones with the Weasley language. It demands an immediate ceasefire. So we had just discussed the U.S. specific resolution, which was incredibly vague and weaselly and used flowery language and, you know, really was more about we support the process of eventually getting to a ceasefire. This is not that. This is real language here. So Trita Parsi says the following. This was before it passed. The Security Council is scheduled to vote on a new resolution at 10 a.m. today that explicitly demands a ceasefire in Gaza. Here's a short thread analyzing the resolution, which is expected to pass. There were intense negotiations this past weekend over this new ceasefire resolution. It is put forward by 10 countries. Algeria, Guyana, Japan, Malta, Mozambique, Republic of Korea, Sierra Leone, Slovenia, and Switzerland. That is all of the non-permanent members of the Security Council. By Friday of last week, when Russia and China vetoed Biden's draft resolution, the E10 resolution had three operative clauses: demanding an immediate ceasefire for the month of Ramadan, demanding the immediate and unconditional release of the hostages, and emphasizing the urgent need to expand the flow of humanitarian aid into Gaza. Over the weekend, intense negotiations took place following a threat from the U.S. that it would veto any resolution that didn't support the diplomacy on the ground, i.e. the diplomatic efforts of Qatar, Egypt, and the U.S. The Biden administration sought to link a ceasefire with the release of all hostages, that is, making progress on one issue depended on complete progress on the other. The linkage could also make one issue hostage to the other. This is the Israeli position, in which it wants no pressure against its indiscriminate bombing of Gaza until all hostages are released, effectively making the entire population of Gaza hostages. The most immediate consequence of such a linkage is that the war and killing would continue since no issue can be resolved until all issues are resolved. The other countries rejected the U.S. demand, insisting that both the release of hostages and a ceasefire are imperative and should not be linked, as it otherwise would provide justification for Israel's indiscriminate bombing of Gaza since Hamas hasn't released all the hostages, which is why Israel and Biden have pushed for this linkage. The version that will be voted on, unless the text has changed overnight, does not accommodate the U.S. demand. Instead, it combines the two demands, ceasefire and hostage release, into one single operative clause, but without linking the two issues. Here's how the operative clause currently reads. Demands an immediate ceasefire for the month of Ramadan and respected by all parties, leading to a permanent, sustainable ceasefire, and also demands the immediate and unconditional release of all hostages, as well as ensuring humanitarian access to address their medical and other humanitarian needs, and further demands that the parties comply with their obligations under international law in retaliation, to all persons they detain. Secondly, the Biden administration tried to change the language of the resolution to support the diplomatic efforts co-led by the U.S., but this is a process that thus far has been unsuccessful, partly because the U.S. has pushed its parameters to meet all Israeli demands. This includes linking a ceasefire with the release of all hostages, including male soldiers. Anyway, this goes on. Guys, this is a big deal. It's a big deal that this passed. You know, potential downsides. I mean, I guess it's possible Israel just blows it off and doesn't listen to it, right? I guess that's possible. But the fact that the U.S. abstains tells me maybe there was some pressure, some leverage that the other countries had that they used with the U.S. to get the U.S. to back off and abstain. That's just speculation. But, you know, it's certainly a potential scenario that could have led to where we ended up. So now let me show you this. Note the applause as the UN Security Council, as they passed the ceasefire resolution. Here we go.
Draft resolution contained in document S/2024/254. Please raise their hand. Those against. Abstention. The result of the voting is as follows. 14 votes in favor, 0 vote against, 1 abstention. The draft resolution has been adopted as resolution 2728-2024.
That never happens. That never happens. The United Nations Security Council has voted 14-0 to demand immediate ceasefire for Ramadan, leading to lasting, sustainable ceasefire, immediate unconditional release of all hostages. U.S. abstained even after successfully pushing to replace word permanent with lasting. And then this happened in response. And this is how you know it's at least somewhat real. This is how you know. Breaking, Netanyahu cancels the departure of an Israeli delegation for talks at the White House about Rafah after the U.S. abstains on a Security Council resolution calling for a ceasefire in Gaza and the release of all hostages. If they felt like they could just blow this off completely and continue going with business as usual, then he wouldn't throw this tantrum. And this tantrum shows he's mad at the U.S. That's what this shows. So what's going to happen from here? Yet to be seen, but this is the first time that some real international pressure has been brought to bear on Israel. And my speculation is probably the U.S. behind the scenes, that these 10 countries use whatever leverage they have in order to try to force the hand of the U.S. to agree to this. But this is the best news that we've heard in a while vis-a-vis this. Some huge news dropped a few days back. There was a massive, massive terror attack that hit Russia. So I'm going to walk you through here. There's a Vox article breaking it down for us. But suffice to say up front, there's quite a bit of speculation and conspiracy theorizing going on all different corners of the internet, trying to figure out what really happened in this instance. So I'll let you know what I think is most likely. But they say here, the battle for blame over a deadly terror attack in Moscow. All signs point to ISIS in a terrorist attack that killed over 130 people near Moscow. But Vladimir Putin is connecting it to the war in Ukraine. So look, when the news first came out, I have to say, of course, my first thought is, damn, it looks like this is some sort of a, when all we knew was, you know, the numbers and they attacked some concert, some band was playing. My first thought was Occam's razor. Of course, it's Ukraine. They're literally in a war with Ukraine. Occam's razor is the, you know, the people they're at war with are doing some sort of retaliatory terror attack in Moscow. So that was definitely my first thought. But then the more you read through it, the more you see that doesn't quite add up. So here's what they say here. Russia's deadliest terrorist attack in decades may not be directly related to the ongoing war in Ukraine, but that doesn't mean it won't have implications for the future of that conflict. In fact, the horrific attack has already become one more battle in the ongoing information war between Russia, Ukraine, and Ukraine's Western allies, including the U.S. The nature and timing of the attack, as well as its alleged perpetrators, have all combined to make this tragedy fertile ground for conspiracy theories and motivated reasoning. At least 133 people were killed in the attack in the Crocus City Hall Theater just outside Moscow on Friday, where a concert by the veteran Russian rock band Picnic was happening. A group of gunmen wearing tactical gear and carrying automatic weapons shot concertgoers and set fire to the building. Grisly videos circulating on social media seen by Vox show the attackers firing on defenseless people crouched on the ground. With over 100 people wounded, the death toll is likely to rise, but it is already higher than the 132 people killed in the 2002 Moscow theater hostage crisis, an event which it shared some disturbing resemblances, and is likely to be the second worst terrorist attack in Russian history after the 2004 Beslan School hostage crisis in the country's North Caucasus region, which resulted in more than 300 deaths. The Islamic State terrorist network has claimed responsibility for the attack, and U.S. intelligence officials have said they believe it was specifically the work of the group's Afghan affiliate, ISIS-K. The U.S. embassy in Moscow had issued a warning on March 7th, advising U.S. citizens to avoid large gatherings due to reports that extremists have imminent plans to target large gatherings in Moscow to include concerts. Russian authorities also claimed earlier this month to have foiled an ISIS attack on a synagogue in Moscow. In a video statement released Saturday, President Vladimir Putin said that 11 people have been arrested, including the four perpetrators of the attack who had fled the scene. Authorities in Moscow say the four were not Russian citizens. So I think they might go on to explain this a little bit, but man, they tortured the shit out of the people that they captured. I think they cut one of their ears off. Just brutal videos floating around social media on this. Colin Clark, a terrorism analyst with the Sufin Center, said that evidence suggested the four gunmen had experience and training. Quote, if you look at the videos of this attack, the way they shot and even the spacing between them when they carry out the attacks, it's clear they were well trained, Clark told Vox. It doesn't seem like these were just local guys who were imbibing ISIS propaganda and decided to do something. I would put money on them being trained in Afghanistan. So by the way, the Taliban, which is now the government in Afghanistan, came out and condemned this attack and said, in no way, shape, or form do we support this. We're against this. And this is a theme that we've seen for a long time, is that even among extremist groups, they say, man, these ISIS guys are way too extreme. We don't support these guys at all. What they're doing is way beyond the pale. Why would an ISIS offshoot attack Russia? Islamist extremist group like ISIS-K have long-standing grievances against Moscow dating back to the Soviet war in Afghanistan in the late 1980s, as well as the Russian Federation's brutal counterinsurgency campaigns in Chechnya and the North Caucasus in the 1990s and 2000s, and its support for Bashar al-Assad government in Syria. More recently, ISIS-K carried out a suicide attack targeting the Russian embassy in Kabul in 2022. So yeah, there's a bunch of potential motives here. One of them is, as they point out, Putin and Russia are big allies with Bashar al-Assad. In fact, they help sort of prop up that government. Bashar al-Assad is, he's a Ba'athist. He's a Shia Alawite. And you had this uprising with both the Free Syrian Army, which are viewed as like the moderate rebels, but also al-Nusra Front and a bunch of jihadist groups that tried to bring down the Assad government. And so you have a little bit of like a Sunni-Shia split there. And ISIS, of course, is a Sunni organization. They could want retribution and retaliation for the propping up of Assad's government. That's one thing. Everything that happened with Chechnya. Chechnya is a very Muslim region within Russia, and there are various separatist attempts that took place throughout recent history there. And so it could be over that as well. There's a bunch of different potential motives. Of course, it just looks like, man, this timing is wild because Russia is literally in the middle of a war with Ukraine. And so the timing seems kind of crazy. The simple explanation that ISIS was responsible would be an inconvenient one for Putin. It would mean that he had ignored the U.S. warning of an imminent attack, which at the time he dismissed as blackmail intended to destabilize Russian society. In fairness, he would definitely not be the only world leader to recently ignore such a warning. It would also be another instance, along with the remarkable detailed U.S. warnings of Russian war plans ahead of the 2022 invasion of Ukraine, when America's spies seemed to know more about what was happening in Russia than Putin's own security services. So it's not that surprising that Russian authorities are already assigning blame elsewhere. So then they go on to explain here. Putin comes out and gives a speech and basically points the finger at Ukraine, which, you know, if you got the second I saw that, I went, uh-oh, because then that means expect a massive escalation in the Russian aggression in Ukraine. Right. I mean, for a while, they had sort of fought to a stalemate. But, you know, it's ramping up again, and it looks like they could be even more aggressive now. So this is a wild, wild situation, man. It's terrible that over 130 people were killed, all innocent civilians just going to a concert. The conspiracy theorizing, I would say, the main one, of course, is Ukraine. The Ukraine is behind this. Like I said, at the very beginning of it, Occam's Razor felt like, well, probably is Ukraine. But then you look at the specifics of how it happened and who was involved and the nature of the attack. It actually doesn't look like Ukraine in that instance. But I could understand somebody thinking, oh, it's probably Ukraine. Russia's literally at war with Ukraine. I understand that. But there was also a bunch of fake information floating around out there, like some people created some fake identification card, which made one of the attackers Ukrainian, which is not the case at all. That turned out to be totally fake. I saw some breakdown of that, some fact check of that online as well. But the other, conspiracies here are the CIA and the U.S., and the other one is Israel. Plenty of people are pointing the finger at Israel. And the link that they make is, hey, do you guys remember when Iran got attacked by ISIS? And it was right in the midst of what was happening in Gaza. But there was also a lot of like tit for tat and back and forth with the Iranian government. And of course, Netanyahu has constantly been pushing for years to overthrow the Iranian government. And so the timing of that was just too perfect, where it almost seemed like ISIS did the attack, but it almost looks like they were working with Israel in tandem to do it. And there's also, I'm sure you guys have seen, there's a number of articles out there from back in the day. ISIS is an enemy of Hamas. Hamas is an enemy of ISIS. There was one time ISIS attacked within Israel, and then they apologized to Israel. So it's like, well, why are you apologizing? Because for geostrategic reasons, they could potentially work together. But anyway, the point is, when ISIS attacked Russia, ISIS attacked Iran, the timing was questionable and sketchy, that it looks like Israel could be behind that. Right. And so people are making a similar connection now, like, well, if ISIS just worked hand in glove with Israel and did an attack in Iran, then why wouldn't Israel also be doing that in Russia? But that theory actually falls apart kind of quickly, because international relations between Israel and Russia are actually good. Like, they actually are allies and trading partners. And in fact, Israel did not agree with the U.S. to put sanctions on Russia when they invaded Ukraine. And Israel sent no weapons to Russia when, of course, we were trying to prod all of our allies to help out, pitch in, and send weapons to Ukraine. So relations between Putin and Netanyahu, Israel and Russia, they're actually, like, good. So the idea that Israel would be behind it honestly doesn't make any sense at all. And the CIA one, look, I understand the CIA does a million things that are horrible all the time. It's not just a thing from back in the day, as many people would have you believe. It's also a thing that they do currently, that the CIA meddles in other countries and tries to overthrow governments. And we've seen it time and time again. But again, it just doesn't add up in this scenario, because if that was the case, why would the U.S. have issued a warning in early March that, hey, we have evidence that there's going to be, we have some intelligence that there's going to be some sort of an attack in Moscow? Why would they have warned about that attack if it was going to, they were, what, later on going to commit it? It just, that doesn't really add up either. So, and then the final, the cherry on top here, the final nail in the coffin of all the theories, I think, is that ISIS came out and took responsibility for it. Then they saw a lot of people downplaying it and denying it and conspiracy theorizing. And then they came out again and like, no, guys, seriously, we did this. And then they had to come out again and release video that they had of it. So it almost certainly was ISIS. It's just because of the political situation going on around the world now, it's almost hard for anybody to believe anything, right? Because it's just there's so much going on. There's Russia invading Ukraine and doing a war with Ukraine. There's Israel trying to wipe Gaza off the map and ethnically cleanse them and genocide them. And there's so much chaos. There's so much instability that, you know, it's almost like you're never going to take something at face value. Everything at face value is initially going to seem like it's the Lee Harvey Oswald story, the official story about the assassination of JFK, where everybody's like, that doesn't make sense. Even to this day, over 50% of Americans are like, I don't buy that. That doesn't make sense. So everybody's initial reaction is sort of like that. But look, on this front, I could say I'm relatively convinced it adds up that it was an ISIS attack. The motive is a little bit of a deeper question, right? That I don't know if it has to do with the Syria thing. I don't know if it has to do with Chechnya. I don't know, right? But they tortured the shit out of these guys. And it was a horrific, horrific, brutal attack. Again, over 130. Last number I saw was 137 and climbing. So what's important from now, though, is how this is going to be used. And it already looks like Putin is pointing the finger at Ukraine. So buckle up, because I don't know if he really believes it or he's just using it. I genuinely don't know. But the end result is the same either way, that he's going to ramp up against Ukraine. And that is a scary thing for the entire world. So AOC a few weeks back was out at some movie or something, and she was sort of heckled by people who were trying to get her to say that what Israel is doing in Gaza is genocide. And she was kind of standoffish and defensive, and, you know, she wouldn't say it. And, you know, a lot of people were concluding at the time, like, this is totally chicken shit, right? Like, if you have eyes, if you're following what's happening, it is kind of clear that what's happening is a genocide. So, led to quite a bit of a backlash. But something, since then, has changed. I don't know what it is. You know, my theory, because so many other people have had an awakening moment about this, but I think this happened before that video came out. I'm not sure. There was a video that was released by Al Jazeera of these four young boys walking, probably, you know, 12, 13, 14, that range, and not holding any weapons, not threatening anybody, nowhere near the IDF, just walking, and they get killed by a drone from the sky like that. There's no way you could even come up with some sort of cover story of how they're aggressive or they're Hamas or what. It just, there's nothing there, right? That seemingly woke a lot of people up, like, holy shit, this is how they're acting? Well, if they're doing this, how many other instances of the exact same shit are they doing? Well, we already know. They killed people waving a white flag. We've seen it 1,000 times, right? Shouldn't be surprising to anybody, but apparently it is to a lot of people, but they're waking up. So she seemingly had an enlightenment moment, and she comes out and says the following.
In this moment, 1.1 million innocents in Gaza are at famine's door. A famine that is being intentionally precipitated through the blocking of food and global humanitarian assistance by leaders in the Israeli government. This is a mass starvation of people, engineered and orchestrated, following the killing of another 30,000, 70% of whom were women and children killed. If you want to know what an unfolding genocide looks like, open your eyes. It looks like the forced famine of 1.1 million innocents. It looks like thousands of children eating grass as their bodies consume themselves while trucks of food are slowed and halted just miles away. It looks like good and decent people who do nothing or too little, too late. It is against United States law to provide weapons to forces who block United States humanitarian assistance. And that is exactly what is happening right now. So much so that the president himself stated during the State of the Union that the United States must and will be building its own port to let aid through. It will be too late. The time is now to force compliance with U.S. law and the standards of humanity and fulfill our obligations to the American people to suspend the transfer of U.S. weapons to the Israeli government in order to stop and prevent further atrocity.
So she woke up. She woke up. And she's being as brave now as Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar and Summer Lee. A lot of them were earlier to it. But she's now at that same place. And look, I will say this. This has been undeniable for over 150 days. Right, this has been undeniable since probably like October 15th, 20th. Why do I say that? Because Israel announced we're going to do a total medieval style siege. No food, no fuel, no water, no electricity, no anything. Well, that is by definition collective punishment of 2.3 million Gazans. By the way, how many of those people are Hamas, you ask? 30,000. So punishing 2.3 million for the actions of 30,000. So from that moment on, this should have woken everybody up. Oh. Because imagine they do that to you. Imagine they do that to your friends, to your family. Somebody you don't know, have nothing to do with, but purports to represent you, does something bad, and then they cut off power and food and fuel and water to your entire block or to your entire town. You'd be like, this is the most absurd thing I've ever seen in my life. This is obviously collective punishment. This is obviously a colossal crime. Well, now, it took a while, but she's in the right place. So after this, of course, this leads to... She was getting backlash from the left previously when she wouldn't say it's a genocide. Now the backlash is coming from the other perspective, right? From people who don't agree with her because they don't agree that this is a genocide. It's the establishment, it's the corporate Democrats, it's corporate media, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so she goes on CNN, and she doubles down. Let's watch.
You gave a very forceful speech on the House floor Friday about the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. You called on President Biden to cut off U.S. military aid to Israel. I think we have a clip of part of what you said. Let's roll that.
If you want to know what an unfolding genocide looks like, open your eyes. It looks like the forced famine of 1.1 million innocents. We must write our story in this moment of what it means and who we are as Americans. And our story must be not that we were good men who did nothing.
Now, clearly not enough aid is getting in. Clearly the conditions for the Palestinian people are horrific and much more needs to be done. Genocide is a word that has serious and specific connotations and allegations. It's defined by the intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group.
Yes, Jake, that is how it's defined. The idea that you don't see that, or it's a question as to whether or not it's happening, it's just so absurd.
Just to clarify here, you believe the Israeli military, the Israeli government are actively trying, they intend to destroy the Palestinian people, and not that what's happening is horrible, but it's happening because Israel is going after the terrorists of Hamas who attacked them on October 7th, and Hamas embeds within the civilian population?
We just told you, they're starving 2.3 million people. How can you look at that and go, but bro, this is a highfalutin hunt for Hamas? Makes no sense. They bombed over 20 hospitals, schools, standalone UN buildings, mosques, churches, every kind of civilian infrastructure you can imagine. Like, what kind of a question is this? Look, I know he's doing his, like, news anchor, both sides type shtick here, but Jesus Christ, Jake, this question is, like, 7 IQ.
Because Israel is going after the terrorists of Hamas who attacked them on October 7th, and Hamas embeds within the civilian population?
Well, Jake, you're absolutely right. This word is extremely serious. It's one that's taken with extraordinary gravity. And to me, the threshold of intent is a high one. It is a serious one and is not one that is made lightly. However, when we look at the precipice of what is happening with a forced famine of 1.1 million Gazans, where multiple governments, NGOs, and even officials within the United States State Department have stated themselves plainly that the Israeli government and leaders in the Israeli government are intentionally denying, blocking, and slow-walking this aid and are precipitating a mass famine I believe we have crossed the threshold of intent. It is horrific. I think it is extremely clear and it is extremely important that all people understand the difference between people and their governments, Israelis and the Israeli government, Palestinians from Hamas. But what we are seeing here, I think, with a forced famine is beyond our ability to deny or explain away. There is no targeting of Hamas in precipitating a mass famine of a million people, half of whom are children.
So I ask Israeli officials about your speech, and they say, we are allowing hundreds of aid trucks into Gaza every single day. They're trying to increase those numbers. They have to inspect the cargo.
They're trying to increase those numbers as if they don't have 100% control. They're the ones who determine what gets in. They've blocked over 70% of the aid trucks, and that's an old number. I'm led to believe it's gone up since then, because that was prior to the ICJ plausible genocide ruling. So, oh man, they're trying, bro. They're trying it to try to let more stuff in. You know what you do? You say, go ahead. Here, I'm trying. I'm letting you go ahead. Drive right through. Instead, they empty every truck, go through everything with a fine-tooth comb. They find one thing that they don't want in there. They turn the whole truck around. It can have 98% food in there. If there's one tent that has some pipes with it to build the tent, because, you know, they don't want fucking houses anymore. They need tents. They go, oh, that could theoretically, potentially, hypothetically be used for a bomb. So turn it all back around. They're trying, bro. They're trying to let food in, bro.
Sure, no weapons are getting in. Weapons Please. That would be used by Hamas against the people of Israel. They also, Israeli officials also argue, this war could end tomorrow if Hamas freed the hostages and laid down the arms.
You know what? It actually can't, Jake. The war will not end tomorrow. If Hamas released all the hostages, it would not be released. They would not end the war tomorrow. Israel would not end the war. Why? Because they said, you know, let's make a deal. You give up all the hostages and it'll be a 6-week pause. So now, even if they give up all the hostages, after 6 weeks, boom, we're going to go right back to doing what we're doing right now. Netanyahu comes out and says, I blocked a Palestinian state, and I will continue to block a Palestinian state. You can't work with Hamas, they're terrorists. You can't work with the Palestinian Authority, either. This is what he says. This is what he says. They trained, the Palestinian Authority trains terrorists for the future. So if you can't work with Hamas, you can't work with the Palestinian Authority, you say I'm forever going to block Palestinian state, and you say, if you release all the hostages, I'll pause for 6 weeks. What you're saying is, I have the intent and I'm going to continue to do what I'm doing, which is genocide and ethnic cleansing.
They also, Israeli officials also argue, this war could end tomorrow if Hamas freed the hostages and laid down the arms. Do you disagree?
I do disagree, because when we are talking about famine, the actions of Hamas should not be tied to whether a 3-year-old can eat.
Ooh. Damn, son. That was a devastating line. And that's right. That's what's happening.
Actions of Hamas do not justify forcing thousands, hundreds of thousands of people to eat grass as their bodies consume themselves. We and the Israeli government has a right to go after Hamas. But we are talking about a population of millions of innocent Palestinians. We are talking about collective punishment, which is injustifiable. And the excuses that the Israeli government is giving about what they are and are not allowing simply do not square with what the UK government is stating, with what international aid organizations are stating, and even what our own State Department officials are stating, which is that they are not allowing aid to go through. When they're talking about inspections, we're talking about US aid, United States aid. And so I think that if we are to operate as allies, then we must operate in good faith to uphold the principles of democracy, which includes respect for human rights, and also proving the value of our democracy, which is that we are different than authoritarian, and we are different from other types of regimes with no regard for innocent people.
Here's the calculation for AOC and any Democrat with a conscience. Guys, AIPAC is going to try to spend against you and take your ass out anyway. From the tiniest, mildest critique of just Netanyahu, because this is how a lot of this is phrased. The right-wing government of Netanyahu is the problem, right? Like, this is how a lot of it's phrased, to, like, water down the criticism as if the next person wouldn't be just as barbaric and insane as Netanyahu, right? Even if you do the watered-down criticism, they unleash holy hell on you. They spend against you. AIPAC guns for you with tens of millions of dollars. So if they're going to come after you anyway, why not take the proper stand as a matter of morality and ethics and having a conscience? I mean, you should have done it anyway, despite the consequences. But if the consequences are going to come no matter what, why not? Why not? Because hopefully we're looking at a sea change now, where people are waking up to the deleterious impact of the Israel lobby and AIPAC money and DMFI and just how much that impacts our politicians and their perspective and the policies they support. And I don't know how much you can, I don't know how much that money can hold back this giant wave of a realization where even 50% of Biden voters from 2020 are saying, yeah, this is a genocide. And then an even higher percentage say, it might be, right? I don't know how much the money can override that hardcore political reality. So she's joining the chorus with Rashida Tlaib, Ilhan Omar, Summer Lee, Cori Bush, and the others who've been the most brave and out there the earliest, right? All I can ask is that more and more of these politicians come to the proper conclusion. Because at this point, it's unavoidable and inescapable. And nobody has been saying the thing she just said on CNN. All right, y'all, bear with me on this one. We got a lot of twists and turns in this story that I have to walk you through. So, as you all know, Trump is faced with the very difficult challenge of coming up with $464 million because of his fraud in New York. Now, he tried to get a bond from 30 different companies. They said, nah, man, that's the biggest bond of all time. We're not going to do that. And so now he's kind of put in a corner where it looks like the most likely path forward is they have to seize some of his assets. That would mean that all these very famous, you know, New York Trump properties or Trump properties elsewhere, they would no longer be Trump properties. It'd be highly embarrassing for him, and would be a massive, massive financial blow. Now, having said that, this guy's a former president. He's a billionaire. Probably he's got 500 tricks up his sleeve because of the connections that he has. And lo and behold, we get this. Trump media merger approved, paving way for deal that could make him billions. All right, so there's an asterisk in this conversation that you're going to see in just a second. He can come up with the cash because of this, but he can't access it right away. So look at this. Shareholders of Digital World Acquisition Corporation approved a merger with Donald Trump's media company on Friday, days before the former president is facing a deadline to pay $464 million bond based on a New York civil fraud judgment he is appealing. Trump Media and Technology Group will now trade on the stock market under DJT. The New York Times reported that the deal will put $300 million into Trump's media company, giving a cash infusion to keep Truth Social running. The merger also means that the stock market price for Trump's media company will reportedly be $5 billion, giving Trump a personal stake of $3 billion. Now, let me pause to point out the economy is fake. Like, everything is fake. Because ain't no way it's worth $5 billion. Not possible. The user base of Truth Social has collapsed. I don't know where they come up with these numbers. You know, by this logic, secular talk is worth $500 million, right? Like, what are we talking about here? This is a failure of a social media company, but now worth $5 billion? My ass cheeks. Unbelievable. How they come up with this, I don't know. That wealth on paper may not help the former president in covering the bond, though, as he can't sell any of his shares for the next 6 months. So in other words, this is giving him the cash he needs, but he can't access it right away. Wow. The Times first reported the merger. Based on Digital World's stock price of $44 a share just before the vote announcement, Trump Media will debut with a market value of more than $5 billion. That means Mr. Trump's personal stake will be worth more than $3 billion. Shares of Trump Media could begin trading under the new stock symbol as soon as next week. The deal's approval comes as Mr. Trump is facing a Monday deadline to cover the $454 million penalty in a civil fraud case in New York, blah, blah, blah. You guys know the gist of it. This isn't as straightforward as you make the deal, you have the money, you pay it off, because again, the timeline doesn't add up. He can't access that for the next 6 months. Also, to sell that giant, that huge amount of the shares would sort of spook the market and make the company worth way less anyway. It is possible he could borrow against it in the short term, but I'm going to throw a twist to you in a second in this story, which complicates it even further, okay? So this, it looks like his lifeline and his way out to pay the fine, but we also get this. Citizens for Ethics says, breaking, the biggest institutional investor in the SPAC that's merging with Truth Social is Susquehanna International Group, LLP, which was co-founded by GOP megadonor Jeffrey Yass. The deal is poised to give Donald Trump a massive financial lifeline. So in other words, the theory here is Jeffrey Yass is effectively buying off Trump, paying off the fine for access, direct line to the president if he becomes president again. And this guy basically is going to be Trump's boss, Trump's daddy, right? If you're bailing him out in this scenario that he's in, Pennsylvania's richest person, Jeff Yass, is buying Truth Social for $3 billion so Trump can pay off the $450 million judgment in return for Trump doing a 180 on his TikTok and China stance to preserve Yass's $30 billion with a B stake in TikTok. We call this oligarchy when it's elsewhere. Remember how Trump came out the other day, flipped his position, was basically like, I'm against the banning of TikTok. He used to be in favor of banning TikTok, flipped his position. Well, this guy who's giving him a financial lifeline is a big investor in TikTok. So now I'll go a step further than this guy. If this guy functionally does bail out Trump, then he's going to get more than just Trump's vote on the TikTok thing. He's going to get whatever the hell he wants. Because Trump's ass is in a bind, and he's coming in and saving him here. Again, it's a little complicated, the specifics, because he's not like he's saving him immediately up front. But knowing that this money's coming, he could borrow against it. But it looks like there's some sort of corrupt deal going on in order to get Trump the money he needs. Now, finally, I'll give you this. This happened right before I was going to report this story. Trump New York fraud bond cut to $175 million in appeal from $454 million. Let's read some of this. A New York appeals court on Monday paused for 10 days a massive civil fraud judgment against the former president Donald Trump and sharply reduced the bond he would have to post to obtain a longer stay to $175 million. Trump's lawyer in a court filing last week said that it was impossible for him to get an appeal bond of $454 million to satisfy the judgment in that amount, having approached more than 30 surety companies without success. None of those companies were willing to write a bond without Trump posting cash or some other liquid asset. The attorneys wrote in their filing with the Manhattan Supreme Court Appellate Division panel. Because of the size of the fraud judgment, the companies insisted that Trump show cash reserves approaching $1 billion, according to his lawyers, but neither Trump nor the Trump Organization company has that amount of cash on hand. The fraud judgment stems from a lawsuit, blah, blah, blah. You guys know the gist of it. So the reality is this. Trump is able to secure a $100 million bond. That was the number that came up the last time. They weren't going to do $464 million or $454 million, whatever the exact number is. They weren't going to do it. They were going to do $100 million. So now the appeals court steps in and says, we're cutting the bond to $175 million. So looks like now he can get the $100 million bond and then put up to $75 million. But again, then the question comes up, does he even have the $75 million to put up? And on that, I don't know, man. That's 50-50 if he even has the $75 million. So we come full circle back to the initial point of this segment, which is there's some financial shenanigans going on with basically billionaire sugar daddies who are going to save his ass in return for his favors if/when he's president again. That's what we're looking at. So the final point is, look, I honestly think it's inescapable that Trump genuinely proposes a national security threat if he's back in the White House, because he's got all these fines. He's in the hole a tremendous amount of money. And how do we know if a billionaire is going to come save his ass in return for favors? How do we know it's not going to be some other foreign government? We already know Saudi Arabia gave Jared Kushner $2 billion, gave Trump at least tens of million dollars for the LIV golf events at his courses. How do we know China or Russia, or we know there was a government, there was an article in the New York Times, but I think it was Oman paying off Trump. Basically, it's open season that this guy's in so much debt and owes so much money because of his crimes that any billionaire, any foreign government can step in, fund his ass, knowing, hey, if I save him here, I basically am the U.S. president if he gets back in there. So I think that's a sincere national security threat. I really do. And so he got saved in a couple different ways here by the bond being lowered, but also by the billionaire bailing him out. But it's still an open question if he could find that $75 million. We still might have a potential scenario where at least one of his properties are seized if he can't make that $75 billion. But it looks like they're going to find a way where now he could borrow against the shares of Truth Social, where he'll probably be able to pay without the stuff being seized. But man, is like some Looney Tunes ass shit. The way that he's like wiggling out at the last moment, but not even really wiggling out. Now he's just like a wholly owned subsidiary of any asshole billionaire who wants to fund him or any foreign government. Really, really ugly stuff, man. All right, y'all. So we have a big scandal that broke the other day. News came out that NBC was going to hire Ronna McDaniel. Now, Ronna McDaniel, that name may sound familiar to you. She used to be Ronna McDaniel Romney, I believe was her name. I think Trump made her drop the Romney thing because he doesn't like Mitt Romney. And she was the head of the RNC. So big time Republican player. Well, now she was basically ousted from that role. Trump wanted her gone. Now you have Laura Trump is like the second in command at the RNC, but in reality, she's really the first in command, and she's basically rigging the RNC in a thousand ways to make sure the money goes first and foremost to Trump and his legal woes before it goes to anybody else in the Republican Party. So I actually support what they're doing with the RNC because it's just going to tank Republicans across the country. I love the fact that Laura Trump is like one of the top people in command there and how she's going to absolutely destroy the organization. But so it's not like Ronna McDaniel did a good job, right? And I think like Charlie Kirk had it out for her. There was a big feud and, you know, they think she's a loser. Well, whatever. So she ends up getting ousted. And NBC rushes in, give her a lifeline, and goes to hire her. Now, the reason why this became a massive story is because, look, NBC, MSNBC, CNN, let's call it what it is. These are the preferred news networks of the resistance liberals, of the standard status quo normie Democrats. And they hate Trump. They hate MAGA Republicans. And they want their news to be down the line, pro-Democrat party type stuff. Maybe they'll accept a little sprinkle of enlightened centrism in there. You know, you could have some token Republicans or token conservatives, but they like their conservatives to be anti-Trump, never Trump types, right? Like this is the formula of those networks. So NBC steps in and hires her, and all hell breaks loose. I mean, I'm talking every single well-known Democratic type pundit loses their mind and is like, this is the problem. This is the problem with these networks. So the other big point here, which I think is a fair point, is that there's a million conservatives you could hire who did not aid and abet a literal attempt to overthrow the last election. Ronna McDaniel played a key role in trying to overturn the 2020 election. And now NBC hires her. Okay, so let's dive into some of the backlash. So she goes on Meet the Press, does an interview, and it's a pretty aggressive interview here. Let's watch it, and then I'll show you some more stuff after this as well.
We can't have one standard for Democratic election workers and not Republican.
But Ronna, ultimately, there were 250 audits. They never found there was any corruption. Did you not have a responsibility as the RNC chair to say before January 6th, the election is not rigged, that Donald Trump lost, given that there were audits, given that there were more than 60 court cases that occurred all across the country, and that Donald Trump lost?
The reality is Joe Biden won. He's the president. He's the legitimate president. I have always said, and I continue to say, there were issues in 2020. I believe that both can be true. You can say massive laws were changed. They were changed through courts or through secretaries of state and not through the legislative process in the name of the pandemic that took away safeguards to the election.
But you acknowledge those, what you're talking about, did not rise to the level in any way of overturning.
Remember,
Kristen,
in November, which, by the way, is when that call took place, in November.
Yeah.
The election happens in November. We're getting so much incoming. Yeah. We have a job to say this was done correctly. Yeah. And I'll just finish about Wayne County.
Yeah.
You know, there were precincts that didn't align. That's a fact. That's propaganda. That's a fact. So why can't you say, hey, listen, these precincts aren't aligning. Let's take a look under the hood.
Let me just stop you because you just said Joe Biden's a legitimately elected president. This is the first time you have said this.
I have said it many times.
Well, this is what you said a year ago to Chris Wallace. I want to play you what you said.
Are you saying as the chair of the Republican Party that you still have questions as to whether or not Joe Biden was duly elected president?
Joe Biden's the president.
No, I didn't ask you whether he's the president.
No, I don't think that. Do you think he won
the election?
I think there were lots of problems with 2020. He won the election.
Pardon?
But ultimately, he won the election, but there were lots of problems with the 2020 election. 100%.
And that's fair.
But I don't think he won it fair. I don't. I'm not going to say that.
So you didn't say he won it fair at that point. Can you say, as you sit here today, did Joe Biden win the election fair and square?
He won. He's the legitimate
president. Fair and square?
Fair and square he won. It's certified. It's done. But
Why has it taken you until now to be able to say that?
I'm going to push back a little, because I do think it's fair to say there were problems in 2020. And to say that does not mean he's not the legitimate president.
But, Rana, when you say that, it suggests that there was something wrong with the election. And you know that the election was the most heavily scrutinized. Chris Krebs said it was the most secure election in modern history.
I'll give you an example.
It suggests still that you're giving credence to these allegations.
When you have states like Pennsylvania go from 260,000 mail ballots in 2016 to 2.6 million, saying, you know what, when you get rid of ID for all mail-in ballots, that's a concern.
This is what I call soft election denialism. You have the people who are all in, the stop the steal stuff, the no, Trump won, and they literally like hacked the voting machines and rigged it, and Hugo Chavez was involved even though he's dead. And like, you have the extreme election denialists, and then you have the soft election denialists. And then there's even one level below this, which is like the Vivek Ramaswamy position, which is like, yes, the election was rigged, but on the way, Trump says it was rigged because the media was basically doing a nonstop ad for Joe Biden and hiding the Hunter Biden story. And if that was reported on, honestly, Trump would have won. There you have different levels, this election denialism stuff. She's squarely in the soft election denialism camp. And this is why people are furious, because they're saying, hold on now, what she's saying is not true. And she's planting the seeds of doubt while obfuscating and deflecting. Oh, no, he is the president. Okay, yeah, he won, but there were problems. And as is rightly pointed out, the implication there is the problems rose to the level of having Trump would have won effectively. She's not saying that part, but it's implied with the, oh, there were real problems. So, yeah, this is, the viewers of NBC are not going to like this. By the way, this is objectively untrue. So there's a problem on that front as well, just like you're regurgitating things that are factually incorrect that we all know what this is. And by the way, do you really want to feed into, I don't even know what the number is anymore with Republicans, certainly over 50%, maybe over 70% of Republican voters are like, yeah, I think Trump won the last election. Do you really want to feed into that? But like, yes, is the answer. She does. And NBC hired her. So let's finish this up, then I got more for you.
Custody, integrity of every ballot. But that's all I'm saying. And you know what? This is a viewpoint of a lot of Republicans, and they think Joe Biden's the president, but they also think there were problems, and both can be true.
But even the Supreme Court, Rana, didn't take up concerns about the election results in Pennsylvania and a slew of other states. Let me just stick to, though. I want to allow you to continue to answer questions about your role.
Okay. So you get that. In response to the backlash, look at this, in Mediaite, Rana McDaniel will not appear on MSNBC amid internal backlash over her hire at NBC News. So they move her. It's going to be MSNBC and NBC. Now it's like, oh, no, it's definitely not MSNBC. Bro, we weren't going to do that at all. I don't even know what you're talking about. So clearly they saw the colossal backlash and they were like, okay, all right, okay, not on MSNBC. So they're like softening it a little bit. Then we also get this. Chuck Todd, or as I call him, Human Oatmeal, he went on Meet the Press and he shot, to my surprise, really unleashed on management and the bosses here and says some devastating stuff. Watch this.
Look, let me deal with the elephant in the room.
Yeah.
I think our bosses owe you an apology for putting you in this situation, because I don't know what to believe. She is now a paid contributor by NBC News. Well, I have no idea whether any answer she gave to you was because she didn't want to mess up her contract. She wants us to believe that she was speaking for the RNC when the RNC was paying for her. So she has credibility issues that she still has to deal with.
Yeah.
Is she speaking for herself or is she speaking on behalf of who's paying her? Once at the RNC, she did say that, hey, I'm speaking for the party. I get that. That's part of the job. So what about here? I will say this. I think your interview did a good job of exposing, I think, many of the contradictions. And look, there's a reason why there's a lot of journalists at NBC News uncomfortable with this, because many of our professional dealings with the RNC over the last 6 years have been met with gaslighting, have been met with character assassination. So it is, you know, that's where you begin here. And so when NBC made the decision to give her NBC News's credibility, you got to ask yourself, what does she bring NBC News? And when we make deals like this, and I've been at this company a long time, you're doing it for access to audience. Sometimes it's access to an individual.
That's quite an admission. We know why you're hiring her. It's because you want access. You want access, in theory, to the audience, but in reality, to whoever her connections are, right? Wow, what an admission.
And we can have a journalistic ethics debate about that. And I'm willing to have that debate. And if you told me we were hiring her as a technical advisor to the Republican convention, I think that would be certainly defensible. If you told me we're talking to her, but let's see how she does in some interviews and maybe vet her with actual journalists inside the network, see if it's a two-way, what she can bring the network. So I do think, unfortunately, this interview is always going to be looked through the prism of who is she speaking for, right? I think you did everything you could do. You got put into an impossible situation booking this interview, and then all of a sudden the rugs pull out from under you. You find out she's being paid to show up. It's unfortunate for this program, but I am glad you did the best that you could, and that's why the three of us are on here to try to bolster that editorial independence.
So look, what I would say to this is CNN does this. They have a history of doing, you know, they brought on Rick Santorum well after it was proven and known the guy's a total freak and a fraud and a loser. You could point to NBC and MSNBC doing the same thing. I mean, Morning Joe is the morning show and is one of their top ranked programs, I think, and he's on for like a zillion hours and he's a former Republican, right? This is not new, what they're doing here. And what you have is CNN and MSNBC, they know they're accused all the time from the right. Liberal bias. And so in an attempt to sort of combat that narrative, they go, no, look, hey, we hired Ronna McDaniel. Hey, look, we hired Rick Santorum. Hey, look, we hired fill in the blank with whatever weirdo freak establishment Republican they brought in. That's their trick to try to deflect that. Now, my issue with it is this. When you look at the Overton window, which is the spectrum of debate that's allowed in polite society on corporate media, when you look at the Overton window, the right fringe of that is often La La Land, where you can hire somebody like Ronna McDaniel, who literally took part in trying to overthrow the last election. And it's just viewed as, well, I mean, look, she represents the voice of Republicans. There's a lot of Republicans in this country. Why the hell not? But that's allowed in the room. Somebody who took part in trying to overthrow the election is allowed in the room. What's not allowed in the room is anybody in the mold of Bernie Sanders, right? You don't have anybody on there advocating for Medicare for All and the PRO Act and collective bargaining and really aggressive against Israel and pro-Palestine. And so like the spectrum on the left is limited to, the furthest left you go is like Nancy Pelosi or Joe Biden, just standard corporate Democrat defenders. That's the left edge of the Overton window that's allowed. On the right edge of the spectrum, there is no end to the right edge. Again, they CNN hired Rick Santorum, a literal theocrat, like a Christian fundamentalist who wants to use government to impose that on everybody. Massive, massive Trump defenders who go along with him with the election was stolen in 2020, all that stuff. So the Overton window, I would be fine. If you want to allow on some crazies on the right, I'd be fine with that, as long as you also allow on real lefties. But they don't. So either allow on people who are actually on the left and have them on regularly, as much as you have on the right-wingers, or if you're going to limit the Overton window, let's limit it in a way that's reasonable, where you correctly say, hey, anybody who tried to overthrow the election and played a role in that the last time, they're kicked out of polite society. We no longer allow them in the room to act like they have a point when they don't have a point. It's not even close to having a point. Over 60 court cases proved that Trump did not win the election. You had the Arizona audit where Trump and his people said, no, but he actually won. Trump actually won Arizona. Then they did the audit and found not only that Biden won, he won by more than they thought he won by on election day. His votes were undercounted. So either if you want to allow in the crazy fringe people on the right, okay, but where are my lefties? Bring in just as many lefties and give them just as much airtime. If you're not going to do that, then no. I don't want you to hire Ronna McDaniel either. If you're going to limit the Overton window, limit it in a way that is more respectable than this psycho shit you're doing right now. Right? Look, I understand. It is true. There are a very large number of Republicans believe the election was stolen. I understand that. And so, in a sense, you're like representing those people, by having her on the air. And it's like, fair enough, there's also a very large number of Americans who believe the Earth is 6,000 years old and creationism is true. There's some percentage of flat earthers. are we mandated to represent them too? Are we or are we not? So that's my issue with this. I actually agree with the backlash to a large extent. And, you know, you could point out, well, they always do political hacks on the Democratic side, right? They do. Jen Psaki is hired. I mean, of course, of course. And that gets to the question of like, well, what's the point of these networks? If we all have grandfathered in that Fox News is the Republican hack propagandist network, I don't wish they were that, but they are that. It's the Republican Defense Network and the Donald Trump propaganda network. If that's what they are, okay, they can be that. And they throw on the occasional liberal to smack them around the set all the time, right? One out of every 12 hosts is that. Well, okay, then if we're going to do the mirror image of that on the MSNBC side and the NBC side, then do the mirror image of that. Don't try to, oh my God, no, we're not liberally biased at all, bro. We're just going to, bro, I don't know what you're talking about. Here, look, we invited on five new Republicans who are, who cares about the backlash? Fox News doesn't adjust because people rightly point out, hey, they're, you guys are Republican hacks. So like, what are we doing here? And so then you see what, again, what happens with the Overton window. You have Fox News, Newsmax, One America News. They are dyed in the wool, conservative, hardcore conservative network. That's what they are. And on the Democratic side, they're actually not even that. It's enlightened centrist networks because, hey, we bring on people of all different ideological stripes, bro. And you're giving everybody the misimpression. If Fox News and the right-wing networks entertain the stolen election bullshit, and now NBC and MSNBC and CNN entertain the stolen election bullshit, you're giving people the false impression that this thing is still debatable, that this thing is still up in the air, that reasonable people could disagree. But reasonable people don't disagree. The debate is biased and skewed in a direction of untruths, let's say, in a direction of lies. And that's the problem with this, right? It's like the media loves like, oh, this is a maverick who we're bringing into this network. They love that story as long as the maverick nature cuts in the right wing direction. It's like with John Fetterman. We're going to cover a story on him tomorrow where Fox News was sucking him off. Because, oh my God, a maverick, a truth teller. Why? Because he's a Democrat saying right-wing things now. They never do that in the other direction. If a Republican all of a sudden comes out and says, I'm in favor of Medicare for all and free Palestine or something, nobody's going to do the segment, oh, maverick, maverick. No, then they're kicked out of polite society if a conservative starts saying some left-wing stuff. So the game is rigged. The game is rigged here. And let's not pretend like the stolen election stuff is legitimate and debatable. What does this woman add to the network? Nothing. Nothing at all. The point is the access, likely. You bring her on, you pay her, and then you're buying her and all of her connections. Maybe you get some inside information coming out, leaks in the Trump administration or from the Trump campaign, and then you can run the stories on NBC. My guess is that's what's going on. But in the meantime, they're also going to have her on air to spew all sorts of misinformation and falsehoods and nonsense. And so, again, look, you want to do this game where you bring on some psycho people with psycho beliefs? Okay. At the very least, give me an equal number of people on the left who are actually on the left. But they'll never do that. So instead, we get the Democratic networks, the liberal networks are actually enlightened centrist networks. And the conservative networks are that, very conservative. Skews the debate completely. All right, y'all, we got some big news from within the Republican Party here. We all know that for a while they've been at each other's throats. We had the revolution against Speaker McCarthy that was led by Matt Gaetz and Lauren Boebert. And there's a lot of infighting among the Republicans. They successfully ousted McCarthy, and this guy, Mike Johnson, took his place. And Mike Johnson was like the fallback. Well, everybody likes Mike. Put Mike in there. He was like their last resort option. But, you know, we knew immediately from when he got the job, there's going to be trouble in paradise very soon. Why? Because the Republican coalition is a coalition you cannot hold together. You have the MAGA types and the non-MAGA types. You also have the people who silently and quietly go about their business. And you have the look at me, social media wannabe star freaks. And it's just not going to work. Now, it's funny because ideologically, these guys agree 98% of, even the moderate conservatives agree with the hardcore MAGA freaks like 98% of the time. So it's not really a policy issue. It's like a grandstanding issue. And so Mike Johnson. Is it Mike Johnson? I'm blanking on his name now. That's kind of funny. That's how irrelevant he is. I always say he looks like an AI-generated Republican. Yeah, it is Mike Johnson. And his name sounds like it's AI-generated, too. So anyway, who's the one that steps up that tries to oust this guy now from his position? Marjorie Taylor Greene. She files a motion to vacate the chair. MTG will have to call up the resolution for a vote. Look at this picture. They did her dirty with this picture, man. This is quite a picture right here. That's the stuff of nightmares. Marjorie Taylor Greene has officially filed a motion to vacate House Speaker Mike Johnson over her concerns about an omnibus spending bill that is expected to fund the federal government for the remainder of the year. So what happens next? Per Punchbowl News, congressional reporter Jake Sherman, MTG has to go to a mic and call up the resolution. Then the leadership can delay the vote for two legislative days. That would put this until after recess 2+ weeks from now. So she's starting the process. She went on Steve Bannon's show and said, this guy sucks, we got to get rid of him. So basically, what's the big sin that he's guilty of? Trying to do the business of Congress. That's it. Like, daring to even have a conversation with somebody on the other side is heresy to her. And look, I have to say, even though she's in Congress, I have no doubt she has no idea how Congress actually works. Neither did Lauren Boebert, neither does Matt Gaetz, right? Like, all the virtue signaling bills they wanted, McCarthy allowed them up for a vote back when he was Speaker, and they didn't get through. And even if they were to get through the House, they would die in the Senate. And so, effectively, they wanted to boot him for daring to have a conversation with the other side and try to get as many wins on their conservative priorities as possible, while also conceding, hey, we don't have control of all the branches of government, we're not going to be able to get all this shit through. Doesn't stop them from morally grandstanding and begging to have the cameras on them and acting like they're the purity crusaders on the right. Okay, so, I give you this. Last time this happened, right-wing media was split. You had some in right-wing media agreeing with Gaetz. He's a crusader for conservative ideas. That's why we love him. Half the commentary was that. The other half the commentary was, I don't know, I think Speaker McCarthy's doing all we could ask of him to do. He's playing his hand the best he could. He got dealt the hand he got dealt. It is what it is. He's got to play it as best as he can, and we think he is doing that. So right-wing media was split. This time, they are not split. Here's Laura Ingraham.
Now, I've been in Washington, and this is depressing to report, but 30 years. I have never witnessed what I'm witnessing now. A party with a narrow majority in the House of Representatives, everything on the line in the country, but committing a slow suicide, the party. This is why conservatives call the GOP the stupid party, by the way.
So she's also referring there to the fact that a couple of Republicans, Ken Buck was one, and there was another that stepped down. Now, the Republican majority is one seat, which means you don't really have a majority. You don't have a majority. Is there any way you're going to hold every single Republican together on any issue? No, because there's massively different calculations. I mean, if you're a Republican from a purple district, you know, Biden won your state, maybe even won your district, but you ended up winning your congressional race. It's a different calculation for you than if you're in some deep red county in some deep red state. So between people stepping down and now Marjorie Taylor Greene gunning for the speaker and trying to take him down, Laura Ingraham's like, what are you doing? What are you doing? So on Fox News, you're going to be stunned by this. This is how they talk about this on Fox News.
Are we going to have another few weeks of trying to elect a speaker, or what happens?
God help us. The House Republican majority is a dysfunctional embarrassment. I mean, Speaker Johnson didn't ask for this job. He stepped up when the House couldn't elect a replacement for Kevin McCarthy. He's trying to manage an unmanageable conference. Republicans need to understand that they control one half of one branch of government, and now they're going to control it by one vote. You can't impose your will on the entire government when you have one half of one branch of government with one vote. I want to do all these things. If you want to do that, there's a simple way to do it. Win elections. Don't nominate lunatics. Get people who can actually win a general election, not just a Republican primary. Take back the Senate. Take back the White House. That's how Biden got the spending through. So that's how, if we want to cut the spending, that's how you get to do it. You can't do it by having this internal chaos.
Don't nominate lunatics is what he said. Don't nominate lunatics. Okay, that's Fox News gunning for Marjorie Taylor Greene and saying, this is dumb. This is the dumbest thing I've ever seen. Are you trying to lose? Again, a couple more resignations, and then Hakeem Jeffries is Speaker. Okay, so now we go to Newt Gingrich. He is perhaps the most aggressive against what Marjorie Taylor Greene and what these psycho House Republicans are doing. And remember, he was Speaker of the House. He was. He knows how these internal dynamics work. He knows how to get stuff done. I don't agree with him politically and ideologically, but he knew how to get shit done. Okay, listen to what he says.
If you were still Speaker, what would you say in response to the people hitting the exits?
Well, I think, first of all, you'd have to have a totally different approach. We shouldn't underestimate how bad what Matt Gaetz did was for the whole system. He unleashed the demons. He went after somebody who had raised $480 million, had gained seats for three elections in a row, and he drove Kevin McCarthy out of office. And from that point on, it has been a disaster. I don't blame Johnson. I think Johnson has a hand, Speaker Johnson has a hand that's virtually impossible to play. And that's where I think some of the people just make it worse. This is the best argument I've seen for why we need not only to elect Donald Trump, but to elect a very large majority with him. When I was Speaker, I had a lot more ability than Johnson did to run the House because I had a big enough majority. You could have 5 or 10 people who were crazy and you could still govern. He doesn't have a one vote majority. The fact is there are 8 or 10 or 12 people
right.
who are going to get up every morning voting no. The truth is they don't even know what they're voting on. All they know when they wake up in the morning is, I'm going to be a no today. So he really has no majority at all. You have to decide. Sooner or later, you're going to realize the bills have been worse since McCarthy was gone. The Democrats are in greater control. The hardliners on the right have done nothing except make it worse. The Freedom Caucus right now has been a disaster in public policy terms. If you think your job in life is to grandstand and complain while the other team runs over you, they're doing a great job.
I mean, Hakeem Jeffries,
Republicans
Newt,
who are in the middle.
Yeah, Newt, Hakeem Jeffries could very well be Speaker of the House in the summer.
God damn, man. God damn. Woo! He was throwing haymakers in every which direction there. Wow. Look, Newt Gingrich knew how to wield power. That was his whole thing. A conservative crusader who actually could get conservative shit done. He's looking at these clowns now, and what he realizes is that all the infighting and all the moral grandstanding among the Freedom Caucus and those types, it's counterproductive to what they say they want to get done. So what he understands, and what any reasonable person in his position would understand, is that we don't have enough power to get through everything we want to get through right now. So we have to take our wins wherever we can get our wins. And that's Kevin McCarthy felt that way. Mike Johnson, now that he's in this position, he feels the exact same way. And that means, yeah, there are compromises in ways that you really have no choice but to compromise on those things. And if you do that, then the cackling hyena idiot jackals in the corner call you a sellout and grandstand on social media and act like, you know, you're basically a secret liberal. That's what happened with Matt Gaetz and Lauren Boebert going after Kevin McCarthy. That's now what Marjorie Taylor Greene is doing, going after Mike Johnson. And look, honestly, I love to see it. I love to see it because they're never going to get anything done ever if this is the path they go. It's like they don't even have a majority. They've passed fewer bills than maybe any Congress ever because of how dysfunctional they are, because they're incapable of getting on the same page, because many of them don't even understand the basics of how to govern given the position that they're in. And nobody notices that better than Newt Gingrich. So if Newt Gingrich is pissed, that makes me happy because Newt Gingrich knew how to effectively get conservative policy done no matter what the situation was and if he was in the minority or the majority or he knew how to play the Game of Thrones and get it done. This is not something that the current crop of social media addicted freaks understands. They know how to morally grandstand and act like they're the most pure and get in the way of any sort of conservative ideology. So, but again, I love those guys. I love the Matt Gaetz. I love the Lauren Boebert. I love now the Marjorie Taylor Greens because they just throw a wrench in the whole shit. They throw a wrench. What guys like Boehner and McConnell and Newt Gingrich knew is they knew how to play the game effectively. As effectively as, and they could get bigger concessions than you would think from Democrats because Democrats are always willing to give Republicans a shitload of what they want, right? These new guys, they don't know what they're doing at all. They don't know. And nobody knows that better than Newt Gingrich. So by all means, Republican Civil War, keep gunning at each other. Because next, you know, it's going to be, oh, Mike Johnson's not pure enough. What, you think the next person, you're not going to immediately have issues with them? You think the next person, oh, yeah, I agree with everything this guy did. No. No. They don't know how to govern. They don't know the way the system works. And the fact of the matter is, one more coup attempt here at the top of the Republican Party, and you could be looking at a Democratic speaker. They only have a one-seat majority, and Lord only knows how many of them can't wait to look for the exits and get the fuck out of there. Probably a bunch of them. So Destiny sat down for a debate with Jordan Peterson, and goddamn. I mean, first of all, as somebody who has talked to Peterson before, it's kind of like a tornado hits you when you talk to him. Like, it's very difficult. You have to pick your spots, when to respond, how to respond, because you know his default mode is like dominating the conversation and talking the overwhelming majority of the time. Now, in this instance, it's like Peterson is supposed to be interviewing Destiny. So in theory, the floor is kind of open for him to go where he wants and take some time giving his answers. But in reality, I mean, I don't know, somebody should crunch the numbers and figure out like what percentage of the time they both talked, because he seemingly talked a lot. And like I said, it's like a tornado is hitting you when you're talking to him. What's interesting about this debate is that, like, I think they're very similar in some ways. Like, both Destiny and Jordan Peterson, they're very, very confident when they talk. And they like to flesh out their points and, like, take a little while explaining why they feel as they feel. I'd say Destiny talks a little faster than Jordan Peterson does, but they give off a similar vibe from my perspective. Like, the way they communicate, it gives off a very similar vibe. So I know going into it, oh boy, this could be interesting, because they could really, really clash in areas where they disagree. And they did not disappoint. So look, for purposes of this segment I'm doing now, I'm not going to get into every part that I found interesting, because we'd just be here forever. For example, I'm leaving on the cutting room floor the whole part on the mRNA vaccines. I think that was probably Destiny's strongest point in the debate, because, I mean, look, Jordan Peterson is just drunk on, like, the massive misinformation that floats around social media about the mRNA vaccines. He kept moving the goalposts, where at first he was like, you know, the problem is that they tried to use force to make you take it. That was his first, his starting position, which is reasonable enough, right? That's not an extremist take. That's a very common take. But then, like, when pushed, he moves the goalpost to, and what do you think of the excess deaths? There are a lot of excess deaths. Where do they come from? And he tried to imply that it's because of the vaccine. And then when Destiny would push him on it, he would back off. And I didn't say that. But then he'd go on to, like, imply it again. And he's full, like, conspiracy brain, you know, all the nonstop misinformation you see everywhere about the vaccine. He's fully drunk on that. But I think Destiny knew enough about that topic where he was really able to deconstruct what Peterson was saying. And he came across looking much, much better. So that's one portion. I don't know. I think we are going to get into the climate change thing. We're showing like a couple parts here, but I could have done a much, much longer segment on this. I just don't want to be here all day. So let's start with this one. This is a moment that went viral when... Listen to what Peterson says about the Nazis and Hitler.
It's because Hitler's lack of trying led him to kill us people then, who ended up dying during the Great Leap Forward or during the industrialization of the
Soviet Union. Yes, well, I also think it's an open question still to what degree Hitler's policies were right-wing versus left-wing, and no one's done the analysis properly yet to determine that.
Well, what do we
consider?
Because
he was a National Socialist movement for a reason, and the socialist part of it wasn't accidental.
He has full Daily Wire brainworms at this point. I mean, that's the only straightforward interpretation from what he said there. He's been at the Daily Wire too long. He has full right-wing brainworms. He's fully immersed in the Ben Shapiro world. And he's now gone. This was Steven Crowder's point he makes every couple of years. Like, actually, Hitler was left-wing, bro. And it's like, come on, man. Come on. This is like when somebody on the left says, actually, Stalin was a right-winger. It's like, you know, somebody can have the an ideology that is similar to yours, but then also do horrific atrocities, right? And in the case of Stalin, yeah, he was a communist. And economically, he may have been more in favor of redistribution, but he was also a massive authoritarian and killed large numbers of people, right? Like, you can admit that. You could say he's both left-wing and genocide. You can say that. And by the same token, for Hitler, of course he's right-wing and genocidal, but he's trying to do the thing where it's like, all right-wingers are, we must protect them to one extent or another because all the bad comes from the left. That's what it is.
And I don't think redistribution was high on Hitler's list of
things to do. It was a strange mix of totalitarian policy.
I don't think it was a strange mix. I think it was a bid to appeal to mid-left and center-left, the KPD and the German Socialist Party, by calling themselves National Socialists. I think it was very much like an authoritarian, ultra-nationalist regime that pretty squarely fits with... people get mad if you call something far-right or far-left because they have
one of the things I would have done if I would have been able to hang on to my professorship at the University of Toronto would have been to extract out a random sample of Nazi policies and strip them of markers of their origin and present them to a set of people with conservative or leftist beliefs and see who agreed with them more. And that analysis has never been done as far as I know. So we actually don't know. And we could know if the social scientists would do their bloody job, which they don't, generally speaking. That's something we could know. We could probably use the AI systems we have now, the large language models, to determine to what degree left and right beliefs intermingled in the rise of National Socialism.
We're going to use AI to determine whether or not Hitler was right wing. We might get some surprising results. Come on, man. Come on. Look, the response to this is very simple. The core of Hitler's ideology is not like, hey, man, he built some highways, bro. And those highways were pretty good. That's kind of lefty, right? The core of his ideology is not like the infrastructure. The core of his ideology, you know, kind of the operative thing, the main problem is the rigid, rigid sense of hierarchy and racism and eugenics and mass extermination campaigns for Jews, for disabled people, for gay people. He obviously despised communists as well. That's very well known about Hitler. So the real operative part of his ideology is sort of like, we have to keep the bloodlines pure and we have to keep our rigid hierarchy in place with me as the Führer on top. And we have to do our mass extermination campaign of the undesirables. Like, when people talk about Hitler's ideology, that's kind of the main point of it. And there is nothing even remotely left-wing about it. Yeah, roads, bridges, highways. Almost every leader is like, I'm pro roads, bridges, and highways. Does that mean it's the operative part of their ideology? No. Are we really having this debate in 2024 about whether or not Hitler was right-wing or left-wing? Really? God, we're going to use AI to determine whether or not Hitler was left-wing. Might be very surprising. I'm going to do a study on it. Come on, man. By the way, somebody tweeted this. Jordan Peterson lived this meme. Far left, the Nazis were right wing. Center left, the Nazis were right wing. Center, the Nazis were right wing. Center right. No, they're left wing. Look at the name. Far right, we are right wing. Oh, man. All right, I got more for you. So this part is on climate change. Buckle up for this one.
I'm talking about the record temperatures that are declared, that have been declared for like the past 5 years, that have also increased with the concentration of parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. I mean, I'm not going to tell you that every model is perfect. But right now we're like standing in traffic with our eyes closed saying the car hasn't hit me yet, so I don't think there's any coming. I think it's pretty undeniable at this point that there is an impact on climate across the planet.
I think that's highly deniable. We have no idea what the impact is from. We don't know where the carbon dioxide is from. We can't measure the warming of the oceans. We have terrible temperature records going back 100 years. Almost all the terrestrial...
Okay. Just so you know, I shouldn't even have to do this interjection. That's not true. he's just wrong.
Detection sites were first put outside urban areas, and then you have to correct for the movement of the urban areas.
He's very well versed in the whole range of literature that are people funded by the oil industry trying to obfuscate the reality of climate change. Yeah, it's true. You can find 1% of climate scientists who are like, actually, I think it's a crock of BS and climate change isn't happening. And even if it is happening, it's not man-made. You could find somebody to say that. But you dig a little deeper into their background, and we've done this on this channel. We've gone through it. There's this one guy, I forget his name, but he was with the Heartland Institute. Like, the same group that had tobacco industry-funded scientists who went in front of Congress and said, cigarettes don't cause cancer, we have the science to show that. That same group was then funding scientists, like scientists for hire, mercenary scientists, to come out and say, that's not, there's a doubt about climate change and if it's happening and if people are responsible for it. So, there. Don't get me wrong, there's a lot of convincing sounding arguments you can make to try to build that case, to work backwards from your conclusion that climate change isn't happening and it's not man-made. But it's all like mucked up by the fossil fuel industry trying to come up with any argument or reason to drag our feet and not address climate change. And he's very well versed, because he had that guy on his podcast Jordan Peterson did a while ago. Like, the guy I'm talking about, who's like funded by the fossil fuel industry and gives all the climate science denial talking points.
Produce an error parameter that's larger than the purported increase in temperature that you're planning to measure. This isn't data. This is guess. And there's something weird underneath it. Mm. There's something weird that isn't oriented well towards human beings underneath it. It has this guise of compassion. Oh, we're going to save the poor in the future. It's like, that's what the bloody communists said. And they killed a lot of people doing it. And we're walking down that same road now, with this insistence that, you know, we're so compassionate that we care about the poor 100 years from now. And if we have to wipe out several hundred million of them now, well, that's a small price to pay for the future utopia.
By the way, this argument he's making right here is the core of what Destiny objects to about him throughout the debate. That Jordan Peterson sort of always gets right up to that line of implying or just flat out saying that there's a nefarious group of global elites who almost are like purposefully trying to destroy humanity and civilization and drag us backwards and do the depopulation stuff. It actually sounds, it's very Alex Jones-ish, right? Like, by the way, don't get it twisted. I think that multinational corporations and billionaires have sort of like an open conspiracy. We care first and foremost about profit. We try to effectively buy off governments to rig policies in our favor so we don't care as much about the environment or the working class or whatever. I think there's an open conspiracy where billionaires and multinational corporations care first and foremost about profit and say, sort of screw everything else, throw it by the wayside type stuff. He goes a step further. It is very like Alex Jonesy, and it's very like there's this shadowy group of ill-meaning, nefarious communists, in his instance, is what he thinks it is. And they're like, they're doing all these things on purpose and they're trying to destroy civilization. And that's the core of what Destiny objects to, because he's like, you always take it too far and you act like it's nefarious intentions from nefarious people and they're actively lying about climate change and they're all in on it. And that's like, that is super conspiracy brained. And that's very like poisoned by the internet type brain, right?
I've heard that sort of thing before. And the alternative to that is to stop having global level elites plot out a utopian future, or even an anti-dystopian future. And that's exactly what's happening now with organizations like the WEF.
It's adorable that he thinks global elites are trying to plot a utopian future. It is adorable that he thinks that. No, global elites are in the business of a status quo protection racket. Because this is the system that they are incredibly wealthy and powerful. They want to protect that system. They're not trying to create some sort of global utopia. I mean, that's insane. It's insane. He's wrong. He gets it exactly wrong. It's the exact opposite of the truth. Okay. Anyway, I got one more for you. I have to share this with you. Go watch the whole debate, by the way. It's definitely worth watching the whole thing. Again, I could have done like 7 different segments on this, but I'm going to limit myself to this. This is one of the moments that people are getting the biggest kick out of.
I don't think you can compare like Hitler to people that are worried about climate change. The worry that I
Why
have
not?
Here is...
Look, as Jordan Peterson has been in the public eye for as long as he has been now, and his time has gone by, he sort of dropped the whole guise of like the wise professor just trying to give you life advice to make you more successful and happy, right? That was his whole thing. Clean your room. Here are the 12 rules for life. Let me be a psychologist first and give just like practical life advice and mix it in with a dash of philosophy and here's what this psychologist said and here's why this is profound. That was a lot of what he was doing early on. And then over time, it's just been going further and further and further right. So now he's, of course, on the Daily Wire. He has Daily Wire brain. He's a very ardent conservative now, mixed in with a healthy dose of conspiracy theory type beliefs, to the point where he's talking to Destiny, and Destiny's like, I don't think you can compare people who believe in climate science to Hitler. And he's just like, why not? Because that's insane. Because then you're comparing the majority, certainly of the American people, probably the majority of the global population. I've never seen a poll globally on climate change, but I'm assuming the majority of people, it's similar to the U.S. and that the majority of people think climate change is real. You're saying they're all like Hitler? Or have they been duped by this Nazi-esque ideology of caring about the environment and trying to wean ourselves off of fossil fuels? Come on, man. It's just so goofy. So look, we'll end on this point. I don't even know why I'm bothering to do this, but nonetheless, here I go. This is some nerd type stuff to even sincerely respond to it. But look, a lot of people like Jordan Peterson, right? A lot of people listen to him. A lot of people like him. Maybe they're unfamiliar with the actual, academic evidence on this, but this was an article from 2 years ago. Case closed. 99.9% of scientists agree climate emergency caused by humans. So it's actually the headline sells it short. It's not 99.9% of scientists agree. It is 99.9% of the credible peer-reviewed studies on this agree. That's way stronger than just saying the scientists agree. Trawl of 90,000 studies finds consensus leading to call for Facebook and Twitter to curb disinformation. Now, that part, I don't necessarily agree with that part. I'm a believer in free speech, even if the speech is hideously incorrect. But let's jump into this. The scientific consensus that humans are altering the climate has passed 99.9%, according to research that strengthens the case for global action at the COP26 summit in Glasgow. The degree of scientific certainty about the impact of greenhouse gases is now similar to the level of agreement on evolution and plate tectonics, the authors say, based on a survey of nearly 90,000 climate-related studies. This means there is practically no doubt among experts that burning fossil fuels such as oil, gas, coal, peat, and trees is heating the planet and causing more extreme weather. A previous survey in 2013 showed 97% of studies published between 1991 and 2012 supported the idea that human activities are altering Earth's climate. This has been updated and expanded by the study by Cornell that shows the tiny minority of skeptical voices has diminished to almost nothing as evidence mounts of the link between fossil fuel burning and climate disruption. The latest survey of peer-reviewed literature published from 2012 to November 2020 was conducted in two stages. First, the researchers examined a random sample of 3,000 studies in which they only found four papers that were skeptical. Out of 30,000, only four were skeptical that the climate crisis was caused by humans. Second, they searched the full database of 88,125 studies for keywords linked to climate skepticism, such as natural cycles and cosmic rays, which yielded 28 papers, all published in minor journals. The authors said their study published on Tuesday in the journal Environmental Research Letters shows skepticism among experts is now vanishingly small. Look, this is what the actual data shows. This is what it shows. And so to be denying it at this point is just wrong. Now, but here's the thing, right? He would take one look at this and find a reason to dismiss this is called a meta-analysis. It's an amalgamation of all the credible studies on it. He would still find a way to dismiss this, and he would attack it at the source, and he would say, I don't believe your data. I think your data is fake. I think your data is wrong. I think your data has a bunch of assumptions that are incorrect. This is effectively what he would say. And at that point, look, you just got to walk away, right? Because if you can't agree on the underlying facts, then of course you're not going to agree on the solutions. You could try to get Peterson, if you say to Peterson, let's assume for argument's sake, this is correct about climate change. Would you then agree with program A, B, or C to wean us off of fossil fuels, to bring about more renewable technology, et cetera, right? You could ask that. But the fact of the matter is, as long as he attacks the data, attacks the study, just like right at the ground level there, you know, cut it out from the roots, as long as he does that, he's never going to agree, right? So in a sense, it's almost like a conversation about something like this with Jordan Peterson is worthless. Because if he's going to disagree from the premise, if he's going to disagree from the roots of the conversation, if he's going to disagree on the data and the facts, which then you can then build conclusions off of, then we're stuck nowhere, right? We're not going to get anywhere. And unfortunately, that's what it's like discussing a lot of different things with him. It's not easy to talk with that guy. I know I debated him on trans stuff, among other things. You guys have seen the clip, I'm sure. It's hard to get a word in edgewise and get your point across, and he usually dominates the conversation, but I think Destiny did a pretty good job, certainly on the vaccine portion of it and some other portions of it. go check it out. And they seemed like they kind of liked each other. They had a little bit of an affinity for each other. Peterson was sort of heaping praise on him at the end, which I found kind of interesting about, oh, you're a good debater. Oh. And so we'll see. They'll probably get together in the future as well. But like I said, watching that thing was like, it's like getting hit by a tornado. Your head spinning as they keep going. It got pretty intense. All right, guys, that's the show. I love y'all very much. Everybody do me a favor. Subscribe to the channel. Helps out massively. Click that bell icon so you get a notification every single time a video drops. Like the video, comment, all that fun stuff. Thank you to everybody who supports the show on Patreon. If you'd like to, that link is below. Thank you everybody who tips on YouTube with the thanks button. That's below as well if you'd like to help out. All right, love you guys. I'll talk to you tomorrow. Peace.